From bureaus worldwide, this is F.
And thank you, Simon. Welcome to Monday's programme. Have you had a nice weekend? Are you in good form, all things considered? Good to be with you. I've got a great show for you today. Thanks for joining me.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, you know who Simon Dolan is. He is the very well-known businessman who has taken the UK government on in the courts over the legality of the lockdown. We'll talk about that with Simon, but he's also got... He's coming on to talk about a film called Another Way. It's a documentary directed by Charlotte Fantelli. It stars Simon Dolan and Sean Collins, and it's a documentary about how to deal with coronavirus, COVID-19. So Simon Dolan this hour, and in the second hour, the brilliant Irish journalist and broadcaster Kevin Myers returns to the programme. Kevin will be on to talk about his new book, Burning Heresies. It's a great read. I can't wait to catch up with Kevin. So that's Monday's programme. You know how to reach me, so I won't bother telling you. Social media. Oh, yeah. Asher, things are only getting madder and madder by the day, eh? Eh? What's it like your end? We've had a dreadful old day here today in the northwest. Wintry and wet and cold and miserable. Yes, 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 yes. Right, let's get straight into it, into the news roundup. You heard Simon talking about Boris Johnson, the UK's Prime Minister, God help us, setting out the details of a new three-tiered system. Boris Johnson, you heard him. Medium level. We'll always be at medium level, apparently. Covering most of the country. Medium level is basically the current measures. The rule of six and the 10 p.m. curfew. But you might move into the high level. And if you move into the high level, they will be attempting to reduce household-to-household transmission. So the high level will basically prohibit mixing between different households or support bubbles indoors. Most areas already subject to local restrictions will automatically then move into the high alert level. And in the very high alert level, social mixing will be banned indoors and in gardens, and pubs and bars will be closed as well. Amazingly, there isn't any information as to how an area of the country would move out of these levels entirely. Anyhow, this is all because earlier today, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Jonathan Van Tam, gave a briefing using lovely coloured charts, telling us that cases are rising, hospital admissions are on the increase, and we are seeing deaths rise as well, blah, 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 blah. Here is Boris Johnson then speaking, very short time ago, at Westminster.
This morning, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer set out the stark reality of the second wave of this virus. The number of cases has quadrupled in the last 3 weeks. There are now more people in hospital with COVID than when we went into lockdown on March the 23rd, and deaths are already rising. And, of course, there are those who say that on that logic, we should go back into a full national lockdown of indefinite duration, closing schools and businesses, telling people again to stay at home, as we did in March, once again shattering our lives and our society. I do not believe that would be the right course. We would not only be depriving our children of their education, we would do such damage to our economy as to erode our long-term ability to fund the NHS and other crucial public services. And on the other side of the argument, there are those who think that the patience of the public is now exhausted, that we should abandon the fight against COVID, stand aside, let nature take her course, and call a halt to these repressions of liberty. And of course, I understand those emotions, I understand the frustration of those who've been chafing under the restrictions, the sacrifices they've made. But if we were to follow that course, Mr. Speaker, and let the virus rip, then the bleak mathematics dictate that we would suffer not only an intolerable death toll from COVID, we would put such a huge strain on our NHS with an uncontrolled second spike that our doctors and nurses would be simply unable to devote themselves to other treatments for cancer, for heart disease, and hundreds more.
But what he didn't mention is that there are many, many scientists saying that lockdown doesn't work at all. It delays the inevitable and destroys more lives in other ways, economically, health problems, etc. We can't let herd immunity develop in the young, says Johnson.
And I'm afraid it is no answer to say that we could let the virus take hold among the young and fit while shielding the elderly and vulnerable, because the virus would then spread with such velocity in the general population that there would be no way of stopping it from spreading among the elderly. And even if the virus is less lethal for the under 60s, there will still be many younger people for whom, alas, it remains lethal. So, Mr. Speaker, we don't want to go back to another national lockdown. We can't let the virus rip. And so we've followed since June a balanced approach with the support of many members across the House.
All right, then. Explain to us the three tiers, you big fat barrel of monkey spunk, then. The three tiers. Here we go.
We will now simplify and standardise our local rules by introducing a three-tiered system of local COVID alert levels in England, set at medium, high and very high. The medium alert level will cover most of the country, which will cover most of the country and will consist of the current national measures. This includes the rule of six and the closure of hospitality at 10 p.m. The high alert level reflects the interventions in many local areas at the moment. This primarily aims to reduce household-to-household transmission by preventing all mixing between different households or support bubbles indoors. In these areas, the rule of six will continue to apply outdoors, where it is harder for the virus to spread, in public spaces as well as private gardens. Most areas which are already subject to local restrictions will automatically move into the high alert level. As a result of rising infection rates, Nottinghamshire, East and West Cheshire, and a small area of High Peak will also move into the high alert level. The very high alert level will apply where transmission rates are rising most rapidly and where the NHS could soon be under unbearable pressure without further restrictions. In these areas, the government will set a baseline of prohibiting social mixing indoors and in private gardens and, I'm sorry to say, closing pubs and bars.
Yes, and Liverpool wins the booby prize. Liverpool becomes the first area, the first city to move into this very high alert level. How lovely for them.
Mr. Speaker, I can report that we've been able to reach agreement with leaders in Merseyside. Local authorities in the Liverpool city region will move into the very high alert level from Wednesday. In addition to the baseline I've outlined, this is as well as pubs and bars. In Merseyside, gyms and leisure centres, betting shops, adult gaming centres and casinos will also close. I'd like to put on record my thanks to Steve Rotherham and his colleagues for their cooperation in very difficult circumstances. Engagement with other leaders in the North West, the North East, and Yorkshire and Humber is continuing. I know how difficult this is. They, like us, like everyone in this House, are grappling with very real dilemmas. But we cannot let the NHS fall over when lives are at stake. So let me repeat the offer that we're making to those local authorities. Work with us on these difficult but necessary measures in the areas that are rated very high in return for more support for local test and trace, more funding for local enforcement, the offer of help from the armed services and the job support scheme as announced by the Chancellor.
You heard that bit about the armed forces, didn't you? We'll come back to that in a minute.
Chancellor, I believe not to act would be unforgivable, so I hope that rapid progress can be made in the coming days.
Yeah, basically Johnson said, look, we've done a deal with these regional mayors in return for their supporting of the new three-tier alert system. We've agreed to give them loads and loads and loads of money to pay for people to be off work, which has to be paid back in the future. I won't flog that horse again because you know this, because you listen to this programme. We've also promised that we'll give them more help. We will help them to better run test and trace, which is fascism, tyranny on steroids. And we'll let the armed services, we'll offer them the support of the armed services if they need it. Now, Johnson stressed that the armed services, the armed forces, wouldn't be deployed if these regional mayors want them to enforce, not to enforce, says Johnson, but just to help generally in these areas. But of course, that's bullshit when he says that they wouldn't be used to enforce these measures. We'll review them every 4 weeks. He said they'll have a sunset clause every 4 weeks. But this is the Twilight Zone. This is the never, 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 never. It's a never-ending story, this. And of course, it's all about getting us, you, me, our friends and neighbours, getting us into such a state of fear, of anxiety, of depression, that we will accept whatever it is they offer us next year. And it won't be just vaccines. It'll be all manner of treatments. Not to mention, of course, the tracking and tracing and chips on your phones and, passports on your phones and eventually chips in your hands and chips in your neck and everything else. That's what they're doing. On that, Billy Poison Jabs Gates, then, was on NBC News Meet the Press last night. Now remember, Bill Gates isn't a doctor. He's not even a nurse. He's not even a janitor. As far as I know, he's never even held the position of orderly. But he has unrestricted access, doesn't he, Bill Gates, to national news channels, not only in the United States of America, but also here in the UK as well, to spin his propaganda. Presenters on these channels are no more useful than those old nodding dogs that we used to see in the back windows of our cars. The presenters are as useless as tits on a boar, eh, Pat?
You have got me there. As useless as tits on a boar.
On a boar. Have a listen to some of this. Billy was full of good cheer, Billy Poison Jabs. When the vax arrives, Billy says, it won't just be one shot. Oh, no.
How likely will this be a one-shot vaccine versus a two-shot vaccine? And I assume you care about this answer a lot because this is, it would impact the ability to distribute, you know, half of the doses, you know, half the people if they need two. All of a sudden, that doubles the cost of everything.
Yeah, of the first six vaccines, there's only one that's doing a phase 3 trial that includes a single dose arm, and that's Johnson & Johnson.
So Johnson & Johnson is the only one of the six that would be a single dose. All the others, the other five vaccines in development in the United States, would require you to have a couple of doses, at least.
There's a second wave of vaccines that will come sometime next year, and our foundation and a group we're part of called CEPI are funding those. Mm-hmm. The U.S. government is not yet involved in that. But a few of those, like one that uses a measles vector, those are the most likely to be single-shot interventions. Almost all the vaccines will require the two shots.
Before we hear the next question, he has a habit of giggling inappropriately, doesn't he, Gates? I'm not the first person out to have noticed this. It's been said to me a few times. He giggles in all the wrong places, doesn't he?
Most likely to be single-shot interventions, almost all the vaccines will require the two shots.
All the vaccines will require the two shots. What's funny about that?
Sometimes I wonder, what's going to be the bigger challenge? The actual distribution of the vaccine or the public relations campaign?
Well, you're doing the public relations campaign, you feckin' goon, aren't you? You're the public relations campaign, the journalist, you are, because you're not asking him any questions. It's an infomercial for Gates and CEPI. Least you could do is ask a few questions, but anyway. the public relations campaign. Billy.
The skepticism about vaccines has always been an issue. And here where you have, you know, politicians kind of motivated to say, you know, they performed a miracle, the skepticism is higher than ever. In fact, you know, our current president was actually a vaccine skeptic. So it's this current situation.
He was a vaccine skeptic until presumably somebody showed him some videos that were shot on Epstein's Island, maybe. Maybe, I don't know.
Situation is the most difficult in terms of vaccine acceptance. What I'm hoping is that as the first 20 or 30% of the population who are most at risk come forward, right, people will see that it's going well. And so the attitudes, you know, they'll realize you're protecting other people by taking the vaccine as well as protecting yourself.
Yeah, I mean, again, this nonsense. By taking the vaccine, you are protecting other people. Well, if they're vaccinated, again, you're back to this, so we won't get into that. It's ridiculous. I wonder, was anybody watching Meet the Press last night wondering what in the name of God is Gates doing on the programme? And not a scientist, not somebody involved in developing vaccines or developing medicines. Why Gates? Anyway, he moves on to drive through vaccination and more.
I do think, you know, the logistics will be tough. The same way we have drive through testing now,
right,
we ought to be able to create drive through for the vaccination as well.
Let me ask you this. You've been working with your foundation trying to, you know, help with vaccinations around the world for years. Tell me how you go into a community that's skeptical of just medicine in general and end up convincing them to take a vaccine.
Good question.
Yeah, we see vaccine skepticism everywhere. It's probably highest in the United States, which there's a certain irony to that. But you always have to think, who do people trust? So in Nigeria, we worked very closely with the Muslim leaders because households, you know, saw those leaders giving, and this is the polio vaccine that had, there were bad rumors about.
Right.
They saw those leaders giving it to their children and no ill effects there. And we were able to get rid of wild polio throughout all of Africa. That required way over 90% of the kids to take actually what is a three-dose regimen there. But, you know, we had to put a lot of money behind it and figure out who would be trusted. And in some cases, if there were refusals, go and follow up to try and help raise that dosage rate.
Mm. Why is that arsehole always giggling inappropriately? Listen back.
Nigeria, we worked very closely with the Muslim leaders because households, you know, saw those leaders giving, and this is the polio vaccine that had, there were bad rumors about.
Bad rumors, yeah.
Right.
They saw those leaders giving it to their children and no ill effects there. And we were able to get rid of wild polio.
We were able to get rid of wild polio. We were able to get rid of wild polio out of Africa. Well, again, what's funny about that? And are we really to believe that these Muslim leaders that were bribed by Gates' foundation were actually giving their own children the three doses? We've seen evidence on other independent media channels of a kind of a fake vaccine. You've seen this fake syringe. You've seen this, haven't you? What's funny about that? He does it again here. Did you catch it?
But, you know, we had to put a lot of money behind it and figure out who would be trusted. And in some cases, if there were refusals, go and follow up to try and help raise that dosage rate.
Yeah. He can't contain himself. There were refusals, but, well, you know, we dealt with that. We went in and did whatever we needed to do to raise the dosage rate. Bill Gates. It's astonishing stuff, isn't it, to be talking about this? He was then asked, finally, we won't hear too much more of him, about the rumours and conspiracies that he's into depopulation and lots of other very dark things. This was his answer.
Yeah, I think both Dr. Fauci and I, there's, you know, things that are suggesting really malign intent. You know, that is surprising, and, you know, I hope it doesn't reduce people taking the disease seriously, wearing masks. As the data comes out, and there's an approved vaccine, being open-minded that that is a contributes to the community, that you're less likely to spread the disease when you're vaccinated. I wouldn't have expected this. I mean, right. You know, our foundation is about saving lives, and you know, it's about spending the money to save lives. And the fact that some of these rumors kind of turn that around, you know, it's a very novel thing, and I hope that the truth can be made as interesting as the lie.
There he is laughing again. I hope the truth can be made as interesting as the lie. What I don't get from Bill Gates is a lot of outrage. Not very much outrage. Can you imagine if you were genuinely trying to do some good? Imagine if you were Bill Gates and you'd made, well, unimaginable amounts of money in software. And you decided, if this was all real, right? If you decided to do good with that, and if you really believed that you were helping people around the world, I think you'd be outraged, wouldn't you? If people were painting you as some demonic supporter of depopulation, or that you were party to an agenda to transform human civilization, you know, to herald this a new dystopian paradigm, to bring it in, I think you'd be outraged. I think you'd be trembling, horrified at the things being said about you. But Billy doesn't seem to give a damn. It's like water off a duck's back. And I suppose somebody listening to this who might not agree with me, they might say, well, he's just being very mature, Richie. He's being mature. He's heard it all before. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that you could be accused of the things he's been accused of and be as, I don't know, benign, for want of a better word, in your responses. When you're given the opportunity to address the people that have been asking you, not asking you, but saying these terrible things about you. This is Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Kevin Myers will be with me in the second hour to talk about Burning Heresies, his latest book. It's an excellent book. I'm really looking forward, as I said earlier on, to catching up with Kevin. Lots of comments coming in. Do chat amongst one another. I do like that. Share your opinions there on Twitter. Hi to Natalie. Hi to Mark. Hi to Liz. Hi to Lou. Hi to Lynn. Hi to David. How you doing, David? Hi to Paul. Hi to Sutty. How you doing, pal? Fabrizio is listening as well. Always a lot of action, activity even on social media, on Twitter. Oakley dokley. Right. Lots to come in the programme. Simon Dolan in a couple of minutes' time. Simon has, he's been obviously challenging the government through the courts here on the legality of the lockdown. But he stars, does Simon Dolan and Sean Collins, in a brand new documentary directed by Charlotte Fantelli. Charlotte Fantelli, and it's called Another Way, and it's obviously about coronavirus. It's to do with Sweden, and we're going to talk to Simon about that in a few minutes' time. That should be very interesting indeed. I'll be back with you in 60 seconds.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the program. 27 and a half minutes. It is past the hour. It is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live as it always is. Monday afternoon, Monday evening it is now, nearly just about, in Salford. Dismal grey old Salford. Sure, you might say, sure, it's always like that, isn't it? I'm not sure it is. Simon Dolan has said hello to me. He's in the room. Lovely, Simon. Thank you, Simon Dolan. He's there. Kevin Myers in the second hour. And Yes, well, let's crack on then. Here's Echo and the Bunnymen and a tune called The Killing Moon on your Richie Allen Show. Yeah, it is a top tune, all right, I'll give you that. Echo and the Bunnymen and The Killing Moon on the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is 5:30. It is UK time. Let's welcome back to the show very successful businessman. The man has become very well known in recent months for challenging the UK government, challenging the legality of the lockdown, which has done, I don't know, how much economic damage. I think that toll is yet to be really understood. He's also the star, well, one of the stars of a new documentary film. I've mentioned it earlier on. It's called Another Way, directed by Charlotte Fantelli and starring Simon Dolan and Sean Collins. Let's welcome back to the programme, Simon Dolan. Welcome back, mate. Lovely to have you on, Simon. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Richie, mate. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Congratulations on the film. Before we get into talking about that, and we'll obviously talk about the legal challenge, of course, to the government, which hasn't gone away either. When you hear some of the things that we were hearing from Westminster today about a new three-tiered system where the worst of it is we close all the pubs down, we stop people mixing indoors, outdoors, doesn't seem to be going away this. I mean, I could wax lyrical about back in March, us being told, well, we need to do this for 3 weeks just to get a grip of the virus. Here we are now in October. How are you feeling about it now?
Angry. I think probably more angry now than I've been before, because, you know, if we went back to March, I don't think anybody would really criticise the government too much for doing the 2 weeks to save the NHS. It's been the subsequent 6 months, you know, that there's just been a total shambles, isn't it? You know, the government don't know what they're doing. They don't know their own rules. The police don't know what the rules are. Nobody knows what the rules are. They've damaged the economy probably beyond repair within a generation. And now all of a sudden they're doing exactly what didn't work previously, even though there's no need, because the cases we know is just indicative of kids going back to university and having a bit of a cold. We know about the false positives and how many cases that are being brought up because of that. And even with all that in place, it's actually very rare. You know, they're saying in Liverpool, oh, it's 1,600 cases. Well, 1,600 out of 100,000. And let's remember that the vast majority of them will be asymptomatic, i.e. they won't be ill at all. So, yeah, angry at incompetence. Maybe it's not incompetence. I've been banging on about that for quite some time, just thinking that, you know, it's incompetent, idiot politicians. A lot of me still believes that, but you got to start believing at some stage that there's a bit more of an agenda at play.
What about their contention that it's not just cases? They've said clearly today, and they said this morning, Jonathan Van Tam, the deputy chief medical officer, they were unequivocal this morning in saying that it's not just cases. We're seeing more and more people come into hospital, and death numbers are definitely rising. Do you not believe that?
No, I believe it. You know, the statistics are correct. There are more people going to hospital with it, and there are more people dying from it. But let's put it in perspective. I think that today it was like 72 people that died in hospital having had a positive COVID test within the past 28 days. That doesn't mean they died of it. Of course, it's this, you know, it's this old thing. It's more than likely 95% of them will be 80 plus. And when you bear in mind that the average age of somebody dying in the UK is about 81, these people probably would have died anyway. They just happen to have had a test, which we know is flawed, for a cold, a coronavirus. That's what it is. And so whilst you can't argue and say, well, the cases aren't going up or the deaths aren't going up, but they're just insignificant when you consider a population of 67 million people and how many people die of all sorts of things every day of the week.
So as far as you're concerned, just to stay with this for a moment, or I'll be accused of not doing my bloody job, when he said today, we can't allow the virus rip through society, because it's going to get to the old anyway, and it's going to be devastating for them. That's why we're putting in these restrictions. He acknowledged that it's not so serious for younger people, but he said he wouldn't even consider the idea of just forcing older people indoors, because they'll get it anyway and they'll die. You don't go along with that.
Well, they kind of are being forced indoors anyway. It's just they're being forced indoors along with everybody else. You know, and you've got situations where you've got 75-year-olds now who can't be visited by their families. How can that be good for them, you know? So, no, I don't get that at all. And, you know, locking up the entire population to save a very small part of the population, that doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense. And if these people really are vulnerable, then let's face it, they will be being protected anyway. They'll be in care homes, which we know, you know, were wiped out previously because the government decided that they were going to put infected people back in them, which was why it ripped through the first time. But to suggest that it's going to rip through, I hate that phrase, but rip through the whole population, it's just utterly ludicrous. It didn't happen in the UK. It hasn't happened in any other country on earth. And it certainly hasn't happened in Sweden. They made mistakes there, which they freely admit, and which I'm sure we'll talk about. But we're just going the same old path again. Okay, you're going to lock down, Jonathan, right? So we've now locked down again, and we've locked shops down, and we've destroyed the economy a bit more. What happens in 3 weeks' time? Or 4 weeks' time, or 6 weeks' time, or 6 months' time. Yeah, we're just back to square one now. It didn't work the first time, so why are we doing it again?
And one of the very disturbing aspects of this is the marginalisation of some of those who advocate what you're advocating. And you're doing it as a businessman, but also as a businessman who has taken the time to research it yourself. But when you have some of the men and women who are behind the Great Barrington Declaration, they've all got very laudable positions at very, very prestigious universities. For them to be completely ignored, that's a source of frustration too for a lot of people. I'm guessing it's the same for you.
Not just ignored, but shadow banned by Google. That's really quite worrying. What on earth are Google doing getting involved with something like that?
Tell me about that now. Sorry to interrupt you, because I don't know anything about that. How is Google doing that?
So what happened was, the Great Barrington Declaration went up, and obviously it was well received by everybody other than governments. And then Boris said, no, we're just going to ignore it. We're going to trust their own scientists, even though, you know, the scientists on that are from Yale and Harvard and Oxford. You know, these are not silly people.
No.
They're all in the business, and basically saying, well, what we need to do is to get away from this lockdown and go for herd immunity. Let's protect the elderly and go for herd immunity for the rest of the population. And then what happened really strangely was that if you Googled that, so if you put Great Barrington Declaration in Google, it just, their homepage simply didn't appear.
Is that right?
Even though it appeared the day before. And now it appears again because there's been a whole lot of fuss about it. The only things you could find on it were videos and articles that were disparaging it. That is physical. That's manipulation by Google of a perfectly valid point of view that just went against some government's point of view. And that's really quite worrying. It's by design. That's not accident or incompetence.
It's dreadful, isn't it? I know Martin Kulldorff. I know one of the broadsheets was in touch with him to ask him why was he appearing on conspiracy radio shows because of some of the guests that were on those conspiracy radio shows. That's a dreadful thing. They weren't emailing him to challenge some of the contentions, you know, some of the things that he was saying, but trying to discredit him by association because of a show that he was on. It's unimaginable to me, but here we are. Simon Dolan is our guest, and we're going to talk now about another way. When I got in touch with Simon a couple of weeks back, he said, Richie, I'm travelling to and from Sweden, or I've been to Sweden, and he left me know about this new film. Simon is one of the co-stars. I don't think Simon would like to use the term star. I think he's a bit more modest than that, but one of the co-presenters, you could say. Simon Dolan and Sean Collins have decided to show Michael Moore how it's really done. Directed by Charlotte Fantelli, Another Way. Tell us about it, Simon. It's about Sweden.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. So I didn't know who Sean Collins was, and I just got a direct message on Twitter one day basically saying, well, you know, this is who I am. I'm a comedian and my life's been ruined. Why don't we go to Sweden and see how they're doing it? And that was literally how the idea was born. So, you know, we put together a few people, and before I knew it, I was on a plane going to Sweden. And the whole premise of the documentary is really seeing how people in the arts have been affected by the lockdown, you know, the overall lockdown, and then wondering whether there was another way, hence the name of the program. And so, like, we went to Sweden and we saw that actually there was another way, and it was kind of exactly as we've been saying, you know, Sweden didn't do any of the draconian things. And life there is really great. It's, you know, it's just, it's really difficult to put into words, but people just seem happy and relaxed there. Probably how life was in England before all this kicked off. But it's almost like when you step off the plane, you can breathe again, you know. It's just the attitude is so different to the UK. From everybody around, you know, they're, like I say, they're happy and relaxed about it. And I asked, we did a lot of interviews and so on, and asked kind of, you know, just normal, ordinary people, about, you know, why aren't they negative about it? Why aren't they worried about it? And the consensus was, well, we just look at the numbers and we see that it's no worse than, you know, than a bad season of flu. And so we just get on with things. And you think about how different that is to the way that the data is presented in the UK and other countries. It's just this fear being instilled in people, you know. And you mentioned earlier about there being a big divide and about people who are so vehement, you know, against lockdown and for lockdown. But those that are really pro lockdown, they're actually, I don't think they're evil people. They're just scared. They've been scared witless by the media and the government. And Sweden just did it differently. They just said, look, this is what it is, and you need to be careful, and it's a bit nasty. So we suggest, you know, kind of a bit social distancing, you know, don't shake hands. But other than that, crack on,
which is what they did. What's the truth about Sweden? Because if you listen to the British government, they'll say that Sweden had more deaths per capita than the UK did. You get this argument that we're being, you know, depending on who you listen to, Sweden did a brilliant thing or they didn't. And a lot of people are confused about this because, again, just go back to the government. I've heard Witte and Valance talk about Sweden. I've heard some of the more, I don't want to say left-wing press, but the press that has supported the lockdown, they say that it's a myth that Sweden got away with it by not going into lockdown. Now, you yourself said, Simon, that Sweden made mistakes. What mistakes were those?
The care homes, basically, they didn't shield people in care homes, and that was why their numbers are up a lot more than the neighbours, you know, Denmark and Finland, which is what people always compare them to. Their deaths per million have actually been a lot less than the UK, I believe. And then people say, oh, well, it's because, you know, the population density is so much less there. Well, as an overall country, it is, but where we were in Stockholm, it was rammed, absolutely rammed. You know, we got stuck in a traffic jam for 3 hours.
No
it's
way.
A really, really busy place, every bit as busy as London used to be. And, you know, like I say, the deaths per million are less than the UK. So they did do it right. They did make mistakes. I interviewed Anders Tegnell, the guy who's in charge of the policy over there, and he freely admits that. But the good thing with him is that he's not a politician. So very different in Sweden. Their public health authority, of which Anders is the head, is the one that actually makes the final decision on what they're going to be doing, not the government. And so you have a situation where political reputations aren't brought into it. It's just simple, you know, public health authority people. So they can apologize and they can just do what's scientific rather than what's political.
Now, that's interesting because presumably, Simon, he would have been lobbied by the same people lobbying Chris Witte and Patrick Vallance, you know, namely certain people at the World Health Organization and others. So I'm fascinated as to why, because the rest of the world appears to have been in lockstep, which I was very suspicious about, and I still am. So how did Sweden manage to avoid? I know you'll think I've answered that, Richie, but why, presumably Sweden, you know, gets directives from the WHO and the United Nations and all the rest of it, but they decided not to go down that road. I still can't understand that.
I can only imagine it's, and I don't know this for a fact, but the difference is that it's a public health authority that are making the decision and not politicians. And so whilst the WHO would be talking to the politicians, they wouldn't be getting to the public health. And I would imagine that what the politicians would be able to say was, well, we can't do what you want because in Sweden, it's our public health authority that make the decision and we trust them. And they've made the decision that we're not going to do lockdown. We're going to do this instead. And you know, we'll see how we go. And lo and behold, they were right. And of course, people have died of this thing in Sweden, not as many as in other countries, but people have still died. You know, there is a disease out there and it does get some people, mainly old people, but it does get some people. So they were always going to have deaths there no matter what they did. But the difference is now is that their economy actually is pretty good. And interestingly, the only reason their economy has been impacted is because of the lack of tourism. Now, that's not their fault.
Can't do anything about that. Yeah.
No, you can't. And also it was very interesting. We did an interview with a lady there that runs the ABBA Museum, which if you ever get to Sweden is actually quite good. But she said, well, we closed the museum in March and then we reopened again in June. And I said, what? So the government directed you to? She said, no, it was my decision to close it down because we weren't sure what was happening. And so we decided that would be the best thing to do. And it's really interesting. You know, the government trusted the Swedish people to make the right decisions. And in the opposite side of that, of course, is that because the government trusts the people tend to trust the government a little bit more. And you certainly can't say that in the UK. You know, it's a very dictatorial approach.
You haven't been able to get your head around it, have you? Anybody who's ever been in business, I mean, I've never really had a business, really, as such. But I mean, I've worked for so many different people. It must be absolutely, I don't know, head spinning for you to contemplate, to even to witness a government telling men and women to shut your doors, knowing the consequences for those business owners and their staff. It's not unfair to call it totalitarianism or fascism. You can give it whatever label you want. It staggers me. And I put something out on Twitter the other day, and I know you picked up on it because you said, well, I did, Richie. I stood up to it. You have done, to your absolute credit, to your eternal credit. But where are the rest of the businessmen and women in federations and chambers of commerce? Why didn't they come together and say, no, no, we are going to open and we are going to carry on. Let them do their worst. Why be complicit in your own downfall? I don't get that.
I really wish I knew the answer. I've been massively disappointed, to be honest with you, about the lack of support that I've had. You know, not from kind of, I hate to use the word, but, you know, really small businesses, ordinary businesses, I suppose. We've had a lot of support from them. And these are the people that are chipping in, you know, £20 and £30 into the crowdfund campaign. Yeah. And we've had 12,000 people like that. And they're probably all, you know, a lot of them will be business people. But it's the larger businesses. And this is what really annoyed me the other day when you see all these people that keep coming up and saying, oh, we're going to do a judicial review if the government don't do this or they don't do that. So many people have said it. And so few people, well, in fact, I think we're the only ones, have actually then gone ahead and done something. You remember the airline said they were going to take the government judicial review if they introduced the quarantines? Well, nothing happened because the government said, oh, don't worry, we won't do it. We'll do something else. And they said, oh, okay, thank you very much. Because, of course, the government's relying on government bailouts. So they can't rock the boat too much. And the people who run these companies, you know, the heads of these, they don't own them. You know, actually, if the company fails, they just go and get another job. It's of no meaning to them, really. So various reasons, you know, you've got people who maybe have political aspirations, so they don't want to rock the boat. You've got people who got the handout, so they don't want to rock the boat. You've got people who maybe have government contracts, they don't want to rock the boat. So, and other people are scared, you know, they're scared because the government are going to come and shut them down or whatever else it might be. But the, you know, the trade bodies, the federations, they've been just dire. They've done nothing, literally nothing. And they're supposed to support their people. But again, just nothing.
I would have been advocating something a bit very bold, I think. I would have been advocating, look, let's all of us open up together in the cities on a certain day and put it up to them. And I know this is going to sound a bit controversial now, but I would have been saying, listen, hire private security. You can't allow them to do this to you. I mean, this is a banana republic. If we allow them, say, we'll arrest you if you try to open your business. Anyway, look, that might be a bit controversial for some. I don't like violence and I never, ever advocate it. Never will either. No excuse for it. The way to beat these people is with civil disobedience, in my opinion. Simon Dolan is our guest. Simon, tell us when can people stay with me till the top of the hour if you can, anyway, because there's a few more things I want to ask you. Another way, Simon Dolan, Sean Collins, I love how it came together. Sean dropping you a tweet, the comedian, and saying, look, what's going on? Let's go to Sweden. I think it's brilliant. Directed by Charlotte Fantelli. I was reading about Charlotte today. She seems to be a very talented lady. Another Way is the name of the film. When can and where can people see it, by the way?
Well, we're hoping it's going to be done. There's a lot of editing, so it's going to be 70, 75 minutes long, something like that. And we're hoping to have it done. She's going to kill me. She'll probably hear that. But I hope to get it done by the end of the month, first week in November, realistically, probably middle of November. And it will be out almost certainly on Netflix and iTunes and all those kinds of things.
Well, I love the fact that you're telling me, because my next question was going to be, obviously, will Netflix be taking it? Because Netflix is one of these companies that's really involved in and invested in the World Economic Forum's Great Reset. Now, I know you know that. So because it is, I'd be wondering about Netflix going forward. What sort of documentaries will it be showing? But if it's on Netflix, happy days.
Well, I mean, if they can show child porn and pretend it's artistic, then maybe they might be able to show a show about Sweden and how they did things slightly differently.
I can't answer that because I totally agree. You're referring, of course, to this dodgy documentary that they got hammered for.
Cuties.
Yes. Yeah, Jesus wept. Yeah, no, I certainly didn't watch that. Simon Dolan is our guest, and we'll, coming up to the time, of course, I'll invite Sean on. I had a Twitter message exchange with Sean earlier. I'll invite Sean on for a chat as well. Maybe Charlotte, closer to the time of the film being dropped. You have to be down with the lingo, Simon. When it's dropped, that's what you say these days. That's what the kids say.
Simon, I thought footballers get dropped.
Yeah, footballers get dropped. You know, films get dropped now. Taking this to court, again, you were the first man or woman to decide, no, I'm not having it. I'm going to challenge them through the courts. It was never going to be easy. And of course, you were kind of stopped at the first hurdle, but you didn't give up and there was an appeal. Tell us, because one of the most common tweets coming in now is, what's going on with legal challenges? So Simon, over to you. What's happening?
Well, what's going on is that we've got an injunction hearing, which is this Thursday, the 15th at Royal Courts of Justice, which is open to the public, albeit it's only, there's only a small overspill court we found out just now. And that will be against the latest regulations about the, it's a very specific one actually, about the wedding venues, you know, when they restricted the amount of people who go to wedding to 15. So it's we've deliberately and tactically kept it to a very narrow focus. So we have an injunction. If we win that, then that will mean that that particular reg will get overturned. But evidently, if we win that one, then it opens the floodgates for all the others, really. Because the main principle behind it is that the government are using statutory instruments, so it's emergency powers, to get all these laws through without any kind of parliamentary scrutiny whatsoever. And that's the far bigger worry that we have. We do actually live in a dictatorship at the moment, and that's not being dramatic. That's just simply saying that when one person decides that they want to implement a law, i.e. Matt Hancock, he gets the law drafted and it just gets put into place. There's no parliamentary scrutiny or debate or vote or anything. And he's allowed to do this because he's relying on the emergency legislation from the Public Health Act 1984, which enables him to do it.
But, ironically,
you know, the whole point behind that is that it has to be proportionate and it has to be an emergency. Well, yeah, our argument obviously is well, hang on a minute, there is no emergency and it's certainly not proportionate what you're doing. So it's one small technical point, but it's really kind of illustrates the whole overall big judicial review, if you like, which we are up for on the 29th of October, which again is at Royal Courts of Justice.
Well, everybody is pulling for you. We'll follow that, of course, as closely as we have done since day one. Can you help me explain to my listeners about these government payment schemes and the furlough scheme? Because I know the truth about these schemes, that the money has to be paid back. Can you explain for my listeners? Because some of my listeners don't believe me. When I tell them that the businesses will be liable for these loans going forward, they say, oh, no, that's not true, Richie. It's a taxpayer. I think the truth is both. Is that right, Simon?
Well, what will happen is that come April, then that will be the time when these loans have to start being repaid. That was the original intention, although I would imagine probably what Rishi would do is just shunt it back another 6 months or something, which is what he's been doing, of course, just kicking the can down the road. But yeah, absolutely, the businesses are liable to pay those loans back. The only thing that would stop them paying it back is if the business went bust. So let's assume the business has gone bust, no one's now got a job, and the poor fella has lost his house because of it, or whatever else it might be, all his assets. And then, yes, absolutely, the taxpayer will then pick up the tab after that because the government has said they're underwriting 80% of that loan. in some cases 100% on the smaller loans. So yeah, it is a combination of both. But you know, the taxpayer in inverted commas isn't somebody else, is you.
Yeah.
And me and everybody Absolutely. Else. You know, there's no mythical tree there. It will be repaid by the taxpayer. And we're talking hundreds of billions that this thing has cost.
Do you remember Ed Conway writing in the Times, the Sky News financial guy, their economics editor, I should say, to put a proper title on it? Ed Conway advocated for a quick sting on everybody, effectively a bail-in. Conway even said in the Times, I've still got the article, that it should be done really quickly and without letting anybody know. I mean, this is just, you talk about a dictatorship. You talk about 1984, this is insane.
The reason he's saying that, I would imagine he would be talking about a wealth tax. And the reason he says it wants to be implemented really quickly is because if it was telegraphed at all, then people would just simply leave the UK.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue all you like about the morality of that and so on, but it's just a simple fact that would be what would happen. The money has to come from somewhere. And put a wealth tax on. It's not going to raise, maybe it'd raise 3 or 4 billion or something. We need 100 times that to pay this back.
How will it be paid back then long term? Because you said earlier on, and I didn't want to press you because I don't like putting words in your mouth, and you, like everybody else who comes on, you know, people in your position, you will take some hits for coming on with me. You're not supposed to be talking to certain radio shows these days, allegedly. But I don't like putting words in anybody's mouth. But you did say earlier on that you're beginning to wonder about the incompetence aspect of it, that there's something else going on here. Because, of course, they know they can't recoup that money through wealth taxes or bail-ins or whatever you want to call them. Ultimately, for me, it's always been about land and property and utilities and everything else, you know, going forward. I don't know what you think about that.
There just simply isn't enough money to repay this. There won't be. There won't be for a generation. So how does it then get repaid? Well, maybe it just simply doesn't. You know, maybe it just simply sits on the books. There's various economic ways you can do it. You know, you can stoke inflation, which would, of course, mean that the debt would then be inflated away. You know, so 300 billion in 20 years time is only the value of 30 billion today. So there are ways of doing it. But fundamentally, I think, you know, there's kind of two questions there. You asked me what I think that they're really doing. This to me is about rolling in some awful dystopian green leap forward, as I like to call it. They've been banging on for ages about climate change and electric this and all the rest of it. They've tried with Greta, bless her, being used for all the propaganda there, and that didn't work. And I really believe that whether by design or by accident, they're taking this and saying, well, this is, you know, we'll use this as an opportunity to roll this all out. And the cost of it, not the cost of the, you know, is the cost of the government's incompetence in the way that they've handled it. But in years to come, they'll say that this enormous debt is because we had to do it to save the planet. That's going to be the next thing. You'll see this melding together of saving the planet and, you know, overcoming COVID. I think that will be the way it will go. As to how it all gets paid off, Christ knows.
Mate, the very best of luck in court, and congratulations on the film. Is there a website you want people to go to look at the trailer for the film?
No, we haven't got one built yet. It's all been very quick. But if you go on either mine or Sean's Twitter, we put stuff up there. Sean's YouTube channel, it's on. My Twitter, it's on. So, it's out there quite a lot.
Yeah, there is a good, it's a decent trailer. No, if it was only put together quickly, the trailer is very good. And obviously the production values of the documentary look to be first class. So I look forward to seeing it on Netflix. I don't mind admitting that I do subscribe to Netflix, maybe not forever, but I do at the moment. So, mate, thanks for giving us your time, Simon. We enjoy having you on the programme, mate, and Godspeed to you and to the people working with you.
Lovely to chat, Richie. Speak to you soon.
All the best, my friend. Simon Dolan, live on Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Really interesting guy. Great to have him on. And the documentary film is called Another Way. It stars Simon and Sean Collins, as you heard Simon say, Sean the comedian. Must get Sean on, we must get him on. Reached out to Simon and said, you know, let's pop over to Sweden there, see what's going on. There's so much talk about Sweden, let's go and have a look at it. Got to check out that ABBA museum, Wouldn't mind a bit of that myself. So we'll invite Sean on, maybe Charlotte, who directed the film as well. It's approaching 6 o'clock, you're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, from a wet and miserable old Salford. Thanks for your comments there. I want to say hi to Phil, my mate Phil Restino in Florida. We love Phil. How you doing, Phil? Great guy. Great resources, Phil. He says, Richie, speaking about businesses and not going back to work and, you know, taking it on the chin as opposed to standing up for themselves. Phil says, Richie, because most people are cowards. They don't want to be the first ones out onto the dance floor. Oh no, says Phil. What will people think? And I want to say hi to a good friend of mine, Emily Peacock. How you doing, Emily? I met Emily and her husband here in Manchester at the Trigger Warning event, the Meat Space event run by Graham and Hayden last year. God be with the days when you could arrange things and arrange events and you could have people turn up and you could have a few beers. These days, well, you're liable to be arrested and fined £10,000. £10,000! Emily P. How are you doing, Emily? Nice to know you're listening. Thanks for the email as well. Lovely. Lovely. Let me read a few tweets then. Conan says, yeah, Richie played a clip at the beginning with Bill Gates saying it's most likely to be a two-shot jab as well. I did. Bill Gates was on Meet the Press. Now, that interview, incidentally, dear listener, on Meet the Press was 18 or 19 minutes long. I picked out a couple of clips from the first 10 to 15 minutes of it. If you want to see the entire thing, go to NBC News on YouTube and you'll see, well, the entire thing. That's how it works. Hi to Charlie. How you doing, Charlie? Hi to Rachel. Hi to Jamie. How you doing, Jamie? Lot of activity on Twitter there, indeed. Hi to Donkey. Yes, cashless society. I've been told, he says, that Tottenham's new stadium, very fetching new stadium there in North London, is completely cashless as well. I guess I'll never be going there, he says. Well, this is it, you see. And there was a story, and I did share it on Twitter earlier on, because the Times newspaper is subscription online. You've got to pay for it. I've said this before. I sometimes screenshot the article. I probably shouldn't be doing that, you know. But I do it anyway, and occasionally, and I put it on Twitter. There was a story on the Times, in the Times today, about how the virus can linger on your smartphone screen for up to a month. Was that right? I'll have to double check this in case I'm wrong. But that it also hangs around on banknotes as well. Now, I don't believe this, personally. Why do you not believe it, Jimmy? Because I don't believe it. Because there is never any evidence. This stuff is told to you and me. It's told to us. And no evidence provided to support it, to back it up. It's just believe us. It hangs around on the screen of your smartphone. So it does. And on banknotes. Yes, cashless society is a massive agenda. We know that. You and I don't think we need to spend any more time on cashless society today. 3 minutes past the hour. Let's have headlines. I think we should have headlines. Because you never know what's happened in the meantime. Here's FSN back in 30 seconds.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has unveiled a new three-tier system of restrictions in a fresh bid to control COVID-19. Supreme Court confirmation hearings are underway for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's choice to succeed the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Pope Francis has met Cardinal George Pell, whose conviction of child sexual abuse was overturned by Australia's High Court in April.
Yeah, the churches, even the Church of England, they can't get away from child abuse, can they, eh? Eh? 3 minutes past, 3.5 minutes past six, Monday's Richie Allen radio show. This is the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. I am Richie Allen, live from Salford, Monday to Thursday at 5 o'clock UK time. And of course, the programme is archived on podomatic.com, Spotify, iTunes, and you can hear it on the TuneIn app, triggerwarning.tv, and most importantly, the programme is always on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester.
Thanks to you, the Richie Allen Show is the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. Show your support for this unique broadcaster by making a regular financial contribution. Just the price of a cup of coffee each month will make a massive difference. Visit richieallen.co.uk for details.
And coming up not too far away now, Kevin Myers, the great Irish writer and broadcaster as well for a lot of his career, Challenging Times on RTE. Our answer to University Challenge. And I preferred the Irish version of it. So I did. Did Bamber Gascoigne present University Challenge at one stage in the UK, did he? Or is it just me? Maybe I'm reminiscing, I have no idea. Maybe I'm imagining things that never happened, I have no idea. Here's Chuck Berry. Bit of rock and roll to liven up your Monday evening, eh? How about it? Chuck Berry, Johnny Be Good on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Michael O'Brien reached out to me today. Michael did. And he's a very interesting man. He's taken the Welsh government, believe it or not, to court over the lockdown and its effect on him and, more importantly, its effect on his relationship. And he reached out to me today and he said, I'd like to come on. He sent me his details. Michael is well known also as having been, at one time in his life, he was wrongfully convicted of murder, and along with a couple of other men, and a very unsafe conviction. That conviction was overturned, thankfully. So a really interesting man, Michael. He reached out to me today and he said, I'd like to come on the programme, Richie. I'm taking the Welsh government to court, and he sent me the documentation and it's made the news there as well. So I said, yeah, let's come on and talk about that. So Michael will be on. And Sandy Edwards will be on. Peter Ebden, who's an absolutely lovely bloke. You couldn't meet a nicer fella. I haven't met Peter physically, but I've had a few conversations with him and we swap text messages and stuff. I'm name dropping now, you see. When you don't know too many famous people, you have to name drop. That's why I mention Jean Anne all the time. I have to elevate myself in your eyes, you see. I hang out with celebrities. I don't really, but well, there you are. But Peter sent me a book, Healing in a Hospital by Sandy Edwards. I'm holding it here. And it is brilliant. It's riveting stuff. Sandy trained as a spiritual healer. Despite she didn't have any signs, there was nothing about her that would give her the impression that she had any ability to do anything like that. But she did anyway. She did it with a charity here in the UK, a non-religious charity, and became a healer. And she took part in the very first, well, if not the first, certainly the largest healing trial in this country and one of the largest in the world, where she worked alongside senior consultants in an NHS hospital to really study the effect of natural healing on people. And she wrote a book about this called Healing in a Hospital, which Peter gave me. The subheading is scientific, I shouldn't say the subheading, but Healing in a Hospital, Scientific Evidence that Spiritual Healing Improves Health, by Sandy Edwards. And Sandy is in Spain at the moment, but she's going to come on the programme for a chat on Wednesday. So she's going to be on with me on Wednesday. You don't want to miss that. I've got lots of other guests booked in as well. So it's a pretty busy old week here at Richie Allen Show Towers, so it is. A lot of you talking about the cashless society. I don't know what to say or do about cashless society. You know what I mean? What can we do about it? I've been on... I go back to my commercial radio days. And in my commercial radio days, we were talking back then about how post offices were disappearing in rural areas, how bank machines, how ATM machines, as I suppose they're more commonly known, were disappearing, and how access to cash was becoming more difficult. And at the time when post offices were shutting down, becoming more centralised, and the ATM machines were disappearing, it was also becoming more difficult to get your own cash from your bank. Banks were bringing in new rules and regulations on the hoof, basically, as they felt like it, to make it more difficult for you to get your cash, you know? So this has been going on for a long time, this cashless thing. And I remember many years ago speaking, around about the time that the euro came in. That's an episode of my professional life that I could wax, I don't mean wax lyrical about, but I could speak about. I won't do it tonight, but I could do it. I was reporting on the introduction of the euro in Ireland and well, in most countries around Europe, except for obviously the UK and one or two others at the time. And I reported on that. And I remember the radio programmes we put out before this became, even before the Irish government accepted it, before the government accepted it, the arguments for and against it. And I was obviously against it, but I couldn't say that, of course, at the time on air. I couldn't say I was against that. I had to keep my mouth shut. But I do remember a very wise old politician whose name escapes me now from West Waterford. It'll come to me later on. And he was very much against the euro. And he talked about the inevitable disparity between the economies of Europe, the problems that would bring. He talked about the reliance then of Ireland and every other country in Europe on the European Central Bank and Ireland's own banks. You know, the loss of sovereignty of the Irish government when it came to creating money. It was brilliant. But he also talked about a future world where we wouldn't use cash at all and how he was concerned about that. This is back now in the very late 1990s. I wish that radio stations back then kept those programmes. You know, archived those programmes. We were compelled to archive programmes for 90 days. And 90 days only, it must be said. They're gone now, most of these programmes. They don't exist. But, you know, a lot of people back then were talking about these things, cashless society, you know, over-reliance, the centralisation of things like currency and all the rest of it. But they weren't listened to, apparently. 13 minutes past the hour. Right. Thanks for your comments. Really appreciate them. We'll take another tune and then we're off to Ireland to speak to none other than the great journalist Kevin Myers about his own new book, Burning Heresies. That's right. That's right. I had to think about it there for a minute. Here's John Parr. It's a Monday. Bit discombobulated on a Monday like everybody else, I suppose. Yeah, John Parr. Yeah, if you're a child of the 70s, of course, you love all the music of the 80s. A bit 80s-centric every now and then, but you won't hold that against me. It's Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show, so it is. If you're just joining the show, you're very welcome. Lovely to have your company. I want to reiterate, I said this, I think, yesterday. I might have said it on Thursday. But because of everything that's been going on, shows like this are seeing a big increase in listener numbers or the listenership. So I do want to say again, if you're joining the program, you're very welcome to the show. It's nice that you found us. The show is effectively, hopefully it's the antidote to the mainstream media in terms of we, and I say we, I mean I, because there's only me here, will always try and find the other side of every argument, particularly if that side is being marginalised or is being ignored by the mainstream media. And you will hear things on the show sometimes that you might find terribly offensive. But that's not a bad thing either. Because I don't attempt or I don't set out to try and offend anybody or hurt anybody's feelings. But that's the nature of it. When you have a free speech platform, you have to accept that sometimes you will hear something. So when you do hear something that you can't believe you heard, don't switch off. Send me a vicious, vitriolic email. And better still, the next time I do a phone-in, why don't you get yourself on the programme? We'll have a natter. We'll have a chat. We'll have an argument. Nothing like a good argument. When you can have an argument, you don't fall out. It's important not to fall out with people over things as silly as your political opinions or whatever, you know. So anyway, let's crack on with the programme. It's coming up for 20 minutes past the hour. I'm delighted to be welcoming back to the show my next guest. His most recent book, Burning Heresies, is an absolutely brilliant read. We're going to talk about it now. He, as you know, is a journalist, broadcaster and novelist for many, many years, three or more decades. He wrote for some of the most, the most prestigious, the most important newspapers on these islands, the Sunday Telegraph, the Times, the Irish Times, the Sunday Times, the Irish Independent. But he also, some of you listening overseas who maybe are not so familiar with his work, you might or might not know, but he reported from war zones in Central America, in the Middle East, Africa, India. He's been everywhere. And the book Burning Heresies is his second memoir, a memoir of a life in conflict, 1979 to 2020. Delighted to welcome back our friend Kevin Myers. Kevin, thanks for coming on and congratulations on the book.
Well, thank you for that lovely warm welcome. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
I meant it. And reading it, I was reminded of things that I'd forgotten about. Extraordinary things that happened to you. And I'd be silly not to, I suppose, to kick off with one of those incidents in your extraordinary career, because it almost reads like fiction. if you didn't know that it did happen to you, these things that happened to you covering these wars and these conflicts over the years, tell us about the time that you were kidnapped by armed women in Beirut and mistaken for an Israeli and subjected to a mock execution. This is extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, I was walking on Saturday afternoon through near Hamra, which is the main shopping precinct in West Beirut, somehow I stood a mile away from there, and these women saw me, and in those days I wore a beard, and they were unusual. They were veiled, and most women in Beirut weren't veiled, and that means they weren't Palestinian. And they had Kalashnikov rifles. Well, two of them had Kalashnikov rifles, the other had a pistol. And they stopped me, and they threatened me with guns, so I did what they told me to do. They bustled me into this house nearby and took me upstairs. And one of them went away, clearly to get their leader, who turned up. He was a young man in jeans. And he was wearing a paratrooper's, carrying a paratrooper's Kalashnikov, that's with a light butt. And they shouted at me and shouted at him, and he spoke to me initially in Arabic, which was a compliment of a kind, because he thought I was clearly, you know, from the area. And I indicated I couldn't speak Arabic. Then I started speaking in French, and we had a mangled conversation in French. And he said in French, vous êtes un espion Israël, and he did that diphthong that is very difficult for us to do, but that's the way they pronounce Israel in Lebanon. And I said, no, I'm not. In French, I said, I'm a journalist, an Irish journalist, and I have got my documents. He said, of course, you have documents. Anyone from Mossad would have the same documents, which was true. And he said, you're an Israeli. And the women are shrieking in hatred. They decided I was an Israeli. And he put the gun barrel against my lips and then my teeth, and I shook my head. I wasn't going to allow him to put the gun barrel into my mouth. And he reversed the rifle, the Kalashnikov, and threatened me with the stock, the paratrooper stock. I knew he was going to break my teeth out if I didn't obey him, so I opened my mouth and he put the barrel in. And he cocked the rifle, and that click, which you know is bad. And he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, bye. And he pressed the trigger.
No way.
Jesus. And at that, only when he pressed the trigger and the thing went click did I realize he didn't have any bullets in the magazine, or he didn't have any in the chamber. But he gave every appearance of being about to execute me. Now, I have to tell you that most of my brain closed down during this time. And I can't say I was terrified. I was just too numbed. But a kind of part of my brain was taking notes. And it was that note-taking part of my brain which is now operating and which is reminding me and you and your listeners of what happened to me that Saturday afternoon. When he had done that, he collapsed with laughter. The women were shrieking with anger that he hadn't killed me. I was standing on the balcony, I should have made plain, so that if I'd been shot, I would have gone over the balcony onto the street below. That didn't, of course, happen. The women were shrieking, and he fell on his knees and laughing. And I said to him, c'est très amusant pour vous, mais pas pour moi. Very, very funny for you, but not for me. And he wiped the tears of joy away from his eyes, and he escorted me downstairs and kicked my bottom as I left, and I fled. And the women's ululations were wailing into the skies above me.
The women were screaming for him to shoot you in the face, essentially.
Yes, well, through my... Well, yeah. The bullet was gone. It would have gone through the back of my skull. Through my mouth and the back of my skull to take the spine with him. So that was the purpose of that. I believe from what I was told later that this was a group that believes in the union of an Islamic, listen to this, Islamic Syria, Cyprus, Israel or Palestine and Lebanon. They believe in a single unity. They were the precursor to Hamas. And they were Islamic fundamentalists. Obviously, I don't need to tell you that.
How do you get over that? Is there any getting over that? I can't even imagine it, how I'd feel.
Well, I have to tell you that I did get over it. It's something that I locked away. I knew that it had happened, that I'd thought I was going to die, but no great spiritual thoughts came to me then, and I can't say I'm being haunted by nightmares of that occasion. It's not the first time I thought I was going to die, nor the last.
Yeah.
But it was a very real moment. I can't use the word terror, because terror doesn't actually describe the shocking numbness that simply clouded my brain. Now, I've seen people being executed in film. And I hope that what happened to me happened to them, that they just, their brain closed down, they didn't realize, didn't fully comprehend these final moments of their lives, because I certainly didn't. My life did not flash before me, and I have not had flashbacks since then.
Maybe your mind at that instance maybe protects you from the actual horror of what's happening, Kevin.
I think so. I haven't had flashbacks, and no one has to feel sorry for me. Lots of people, your listeners, can feel sorry for, but I'm not one of those people. Nothing that's happened to me deserves any pity or sympathy from anybody.
Kevin Myers is our guest, and my audience knows I don't recommend very much at all. I recommend you buy and read Burning Heresies. You don't get a chance these days to read of a journalist's experiences, his travels throughout the world, basically, you know, covering conflicts and the places we've mentioned earlier on. What does it do to you? Here's a more forensic question, or maybe it isn't, Kevin. Does it harden you and make you cynical, and does it maybe become difficult for you then to separate what happened to you from your work thereafter? And does it make it more difficult for you to report fairly on what's happening?
It's impossible to report fairly on situations like that. So let's get that out of the way. All you can do is report on what you see, and what you see is not in any sense a complete picture, and it's incredibly incomplete. But I have to tell you, if I've given your listeners any sense of me being brave, that's an incorrect impression. I am not brave. I never intended to be brave. I never was brave, but I found myself in circumstances outside my control. You were kind enough not to tell your listeners that I had done my best not to go to Beirut. When I was going to Israel earlier, I had insisted that they stamp my passport, so I couldn't enter Beirut. But the Irish Times then, being very ingenious, got me a fresh passport from the Department of Foreign Affairs in Dublin. So with a virgin passport, I was able to enter Lebanon, which doesn't allow Israeli passport holders in, or people who've been to Israel. So that's why I was able to experience the experiences I underwent in Beirut. But I must point out that I was doing my best to avoid it. Similarly, in Bosnia, I didn't choose to go to Bosnia. It was one of those things that happened, and I'm glad I went, but there wasn't a second there, and also in Beirut, when I didn't wish to be back home. And that's true for an awful lot of journalists. And I'm not in any sense like those journalists who are quite intrepid and are fearless. And I pay honour to some of those who were killed in action. They were friends of mine and colleagues of mine, and they were under fire with me. But they died and I didn't. I remember those particularly.
You've seen people, you've witnessed people being murdered in front of your eyes. How do you process that when it happens? I mean, I'm a bit squeamish at the best of times. And, you know, heaven forbid, but if somebody close to me was laid out in the chapel, you know, before the funeral mass, I'd struggle, Kevin. I mean, you have seen the worst of humanity. I think at sometimes you've seen the best of it as well, but you've seen the worst of it. How do you deal? How do you process that stuff?
Well, you don't. You see what you see. You don't allow the vulnerable part of you to come to the fore. I did in the early days of my seeing people being killed, after I saw the first British soldier to die, that I personally saw in Northern Ireland. I went home and wept. He was killed in an ambush in Belfast. And I did go weep at that. But I didn't thereafter, although some killings remain with me, and there's one killing that I detail in my account there of a young Palestinian girl who was shot, and I don't know by whom. It certainly wasn't by Israelis. And it was by either a Lebanese or a Palestinian, but she was a teenage girl and she was wearing a purple scarf, and I was sitting in the car. She was standing nearby, our eyes met, the way you do with strangers. We both nodded at one another. She smiled, and next minute she was down with a bullet through her neck. And my driver drove away, and by chance I was in the hospital when they brought her body in and the blood pouring out of her neck. Now, she has never left me.
Yeah.
But again, it's not a story that makes me feel personally compromised, or it was something that I witnessed. It wasn't me. I wasn't her brother or her father or her uncle. I wasn't one of those who rightly grieve at her loss. I was a witness. I saw her in life and I saw her in death. And I see her almost every day of my life, but it doesn't cause me great anguish. It's a fact. She's gone. She's dead. She would be a middle-aged woman now. And that's over. It's over for so many people that, you know, in the troubles that I saw and the places I've been, in starting in Northern Ireland and then on to Beirut and then on to Bosnia. And those of us who were there and who have come through are very, very lucky, and nothing that should be said about us in any way should treat us in any way special. We just happened to be there.
I think you're genuinely modest. I say to folks again, I've not read a book like this before, Burning Heresies by Kevin Myers. A friend of mine called Bill O'Brien, who will be listening, Bill is an old radio pal, and he never missed one of your columns. And like Alan Chatter said in his brilliant review of the book for The Independent, he assigned every adjective to you that you could possibly give: cantankerous, contrary, brilliantly funny, provocative, informative. And Bill said to me, he said, never missed Kevin's column. But ask him, he said, ask him, when you rub up against the worst of humanity, when people are at their very worst, does it harden you to life? Does it harden you to, you know, your own relationships? And does it harden you in your work? Does cynicism become inevitable, Kevin?
Not in my case, simply because I didn't have the sternness of character that would enable me to endure. I didn't. Lots of people continue to go back to wars. I chose not to.
Yeah.
The last time I was in action, the last time I left Bosnia and Beirut, was one of the happiest days in my life. I had sworn I would never go back to action again. So I'm not a warrior kind of journalist. I'm not that kind of indomitable person. Does it make me cynical? Well, look, life makes you cynical. You don't have to go to Bosnia to be cynical about human nature. Just read newspapers, watch your television, watch what is said or listen to what's said on social media. That's all the evidence you need that we are a fallen species. You know, none of the things that happened to me were required to prove what a hideous species human beings can be. This is what we are. It's what we've always been since Eden. And you don't need to go to a battlefront to discover that. Just read a history book for a couple of minutes. That'll tell you all you need to know. But I have to, I'm delighted for you to talk to me about those times, but it's my memoir is, of course, not based on my experiences solely in war.
No, of course not. No, I just had to begin with the story in Beirut because it's not something that many people in this part of the world, I suppose, could ever imagine happening to them. We're talking about Burning Heresies. It's kind of like, I suppose, part two of Watching the Door, a memoir, which is a brilliant book. It really is. There's more of you in this, and there's more vulnerability in it. There's more humour in it. I mean, it really is a terrific read. Speaking of humour, I was laughing out loud reading about your air travel experience in Panama. It's laugh out loud stuff, but I guess if you were there, it wouldn't have been that funny. Tell us about travelling on a plane that was chartered in Panama through a horrendous storm and how it all nearly ended in tears. It's a great story, Kevin.
Well, I hope I do it justice. No, we were going to visit the Imbra Indians in the middle of Panama. Panama has a reputation for being the home of hats and canal, but it's got some of the densest rainforest in the world. It's really dense, impenetrable stuff. And I assume the rain was cascading down, and like the rain hitting the airport tarmac was bouncing up and hitting me under the chin. I was being rained from the ground. It was so powerful. And I said, well, to the rest of the crew from my people from Gurtha, the hunger agency, we'll never fly in this. And well, actually, the Scottish Aviation plane turned up. That Scottish Aviation is the name of the manufacturer. We got into this little tube of a plane, and each two seats had its own door. So we got in a sequence, and I found myself sitting next to a heap of dead chickens. That was my fellow passenger. Everyone else was sitting two by two, up to the pilot, who had a passenger beside him. And there was no way we could take off because the rain was so heavy. You couldn't see anything. You could see absolutely nothing. The air was as transparent as the Berlin Wall. But we took off, and I could see nothing, and the pilot could see nothing. And we took off, and went up about 50 feet and dropped 49, leaving most of our brains and our stomach 49 feet above us. And then the plane hauled itself up again, not to say 50 or 60, and then dropped another 40 feet. So by small increments, we managed to climb out of Panama City. And the chickens, long dead, were falling over me in heaps. Now, as I said in the book, I was just astonished that that I didn't soil myself and the rest of the passengers didn't soil themselves. But the chickens themselves showed no such restraint. So their bowels were copiously emptying all over me. Yeah. And just in front of me, a woman decided this is too much. And she had a door beside her. And she got up to open the door. We were now about 5,000 feet. If she'd opened the door, she would have torn the plane in half. So the two people, the man beside her and the man in front of her, were wrestling with her, trying to control her, to keep her from opening the door, while I was wrestling with my dead chickens, my cloacal chickens. I don't know if any of you know Jackson Pollock's paintings, but that's what I resembled at the end of the flight. Now, the pilot could see nothing. So what he did was he put on his goggles and opened the side window and flew with his head sticking out of the window so that he could see something of what's ahead of him.
Absolutely.
And he was flying through rain clouds, as I said, like a Berlin Wall. And I glimpsed, and then he glimpsed, a gap in the clouds, and we saw an airstrip, an incredible stroke. And he flipped the Trilander, that's the name of the plane, on its back and dived like a Stuka from the Second World War onto the airstrip and managed to land. And my party got off with relief, and the plane vanished, with our luggage, of course. And there we were in the middle of the Panamanian jungle.
I would have never gotten on a plane again. It's some story. It's vividly described in the book. Again, quoting Alan Shatter in The Independent, I mean, you're an absolutely amazingly descriptive and brilliant writer. It's a great book. Burning Heresies we're talking about. Tell me why the Great War and acknowledging and speaking up for the Irish soldiers who died in the First World War, why was that so important to you throughout the course of your career?
Because it was a great untruth that the Irish had not served by the hundreds of thousands in the Great War. It was the great lie of Irish intellectual and scholarly life and journalistic life and historical life and political life. That somehow or other, the only true Irishman had stayed behind to take part in the 1916 Rising, when the numbers are proportions that are absurd. The number of people who took part in the Easter Rising wouldn't have been 100th or 200th or 300th of the numbers of men who were serving in the Royal the British Army, the Royal Flying Corps, the Royal Navy, later the Royal Air Force. And never mind the Canadians and Americans and so on, armed forces. So this was a complete blank in education and in perception and in historical studies in Ireland. And I was aware of this. And when I started writing in the Irish Times in 1980, I was determined to correct this ignorance. And that ignorance was accompanied by a great deal of hostility. This ignorance was protected. No one may violate that ignorance. To violate that ignorance and to say that hundreds of thousands of Irishmen had served in the, with the forces of the Crown, Irish nationalists who wanted independence for Ireland, nonetheless had very generously offered to serve in the British Army during the Great War. And this has been totally forgotten by the people who had created the Irish state in after 1916, 1918, 1920, 1921. And they created a narrative that excluded these hundreds of thousands of Irishmen, and I was determined to create a new narrative. And it took me a long time, it took me a very long time, battling against a great deal of hostility, I mean, very personal hostility. But I don't think anyone could deny that I was successful. And in 2016, when the Battle of the Somme was commemorated, there was a uniformed soldier of the Irish Republic standing alongside an Irish soldier from the British Army, a Canadian soldier, a New Zealander, an Australian, and a British soldier. And that was the collective of the, if you like, the Commonwealth contribution, Commonwealth and Imperial contribution to the Western Front. And finally, the Irish were there in the way that they had never been before in the previous century.
I understand you got a mention when the Queen visited Ireland a few years back. Mary McAleath was hosting the Queen. I believe you got a mention, Kevin.
Well, she did see me. I hadn't been invited to the affair for whatever reason, and this thing called Official Ireland has been reluctant to concede anything that I on this front to me. But I managed to get an invitation from the British Legion, so I was there as the British Legion representative, unofficial. I'm not a member of the British Legion. And Mary McAleese, who wouldn't have known me, but I had never met her, she was taking the Queen around the Island Bridge Memorial Park, which honours the Irish dead of the Great War, and she looked at me and said, "Oh, Kevin, is that you?" And I said, yeah, I actually don't know what I said because I was too confused. And she, Mary McAleese, turned around to, President McAleese turned around to the Queen and said, this is what it was reported in the Irish Times. I have no memory of it myself. This is the journalist who kept the flame of this place going for so many years. And like so many long battles, it was worth fighting. So I was grateful for that public acknowledgement from
well, it was, it doesn't get any more official or public, does it? Why do you think then, looking back, that your, you wouldn't say campaign, your efforts to keep the memory of those soldiers alive and to have it talked about and acknowledged, why do you think there was so much hostility early on?
Because it was disturbing a narrative that people were comfortable with, and this narrative was simple, and people like everywhere, it's not an Irish thing, people everywhere like simple narratives. And I can dismantle any myth about any people, whether it's the Battle of Britain or the storming of the Bastille or American Civil War or slavery, all of these things. Every single popularly perceived event has been simplified to the point of complete confusion and mystification and falsehood. But this was an important one for me because it went right to the heart of the meaning of Irishness. For me personally, I am called Kevin after my uncle, who gave his life freely as an Irish Catholic and a nationalist, who volunteered to serve in the war against Hitler and left his young bones in Africa. And I actually didn't have any direct members of my family involved in the Great War. But I knew that it was a genuine feature of Irishness, having served in the British Army or the British forces generally. And I was determined that this aspect of Irish life, of Irish history, this Irish truth should be recognised. And it is recognised.
You're absolutely right. You're right. You're 100% right. Regardless of what anybody thinks about the First World War and why it happened and the needless slaughter of, you know, 20 million people, doesn't matter. You're absolutely right. It was hardly touched on when I was in secondary school at all. I mean, it just wasn't. It would have been later learning, further study for me to understand any of that. So you're right. And, you know, it's all credit to you and to your efforts, regardless of what people think about why things happened. When things happen, they should be discussed and they should be acknowledged.
That's it. That's the only thing I can't tell you. I've spent my entire adult life reading about the First World War, and I still don't know how to stop it.
Yeah.
Once the machinery of war had begun, I still don't know how to stop it. I don't know how to have stopped it while it was underway. I just don't know. I just can't see the machinery. So it is one of the darkest episodes, if not the darkest episode in human history, because it was the prelude to the other and greater calamity the Second World War, but there would have been no Second World War, obviously, without the First World War. So these are conjoined horrors that are central to European history and world history and Irish history.
Yeah, no
and
doubt.
I'm proud to have done something on that subject, very proud. And when I die, people, Official Ireland, which you and I understand is the title we give to that central kind of identity-forming force in Irish life, which are essentially the media and the political classes, they'll deny I had anything to do with that. Well, they can deny to their heart's content. I know the truth, and most people do know the truth. Most Irish people know the truth. And I'm content for that. As long as, you know, somewhere or other, my uncle Kevin Teven, Captain Royal Army Medical Corps, is remembered in the greater Irish nation, and I'm proud of that.
Good stuff, Kevin. Burning Heresies is the book. We've got, Kevin, for 10 more minutes, so we've got to finish with... obviously, the events of the last few years, our listeners will know that Kevin Myers, who's on the line to us now, this, in my opinion, it's my opinion, and maybe I shouldn't be so soft on Kevin, but I have a lot of time for Kevin, a terrific writer, great author, was stitched up by his own newspaper a few years ago, only 4 years ago, writing a column.
3.5.
3.5 years ago, writing a column, commenting on the BBC gender pay gap and all that nonsense. And Kevin threw a quip in there about how Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz, you know, Jewish people are not known for their stupidity when it comes to making deals. There was nothing wrong with it. I'm not going to get into that again. But it had catastrophic consequences for Kevin Myers. And most of our listeners will know this now. He was summarily fired from his job and denounced as an anti-Semite. And later he was denounced as a Holocaust denier. It couldn't be more ridiculous if you had, it's pure folly, madness in the extreme, the personal consequences for a throwaway line. Devastating for Kevin at the time. And that's when we met Kevin on this programme. Kevin doesn't know me, but when I worked at WLR many, 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 many years ago, I arranged, probably through Kevin's literary agent, a couple of interviews with Billy McCarthy and other presenters. Terrible thing, Kevin. And you deal with it in the book. And I'm going to say this. I love the way you approach it in the book. It's not bitter at all. Did you think about that? Did you think about how you were going to approach writing about it?
I mean, one thing I can tell you, Richie, and it's the most important thing I can say to anyone, to you and to your audience, never, ever be bitter. You're doing your enemy's work when you're bitter. So what was done to me was shocking, but look, at the beginning of that week, that terrible week, the worst week of my year, apart from the death of my parents, but easily the worst week, I was one of the 0.01% of the luckiest, happiest, most fortunate people in the world. I still am within that minor, tiny percentile of incredibly fortunate people. So whatever people feel about this, the one thing I do not deserve is pity. I am not a victim. These people destroyed their own reputation in time. When history looks back at this affair, I will come through as a bit of an idiot, but not a bad one. But these others, they must stand before the bar of history to be assessed and judged for what they have done to me.
Yeah.
Now, I was asked to do the subject of, write on the subject of pay differentials within the BBC. I said, no, I wanted to do something else. I gave two alternative subjects, and they said, my page editor said, no, we want you to do this. So I did it. It was a poor article. I've always accepted that. But I did point out, as a matter of congratulations, with reference to that chutzpah, which is a Yiddish word, which recognizes compliment for their spirit and their willingness to stand up for themselves, their nerve, that these two ladies were Jewish. It was not meant in any way, other way. But anyway, it was filed on a Thursday, and the normal file time is Friday midday, so they had plenty of time to consider what I'd written.
Yeah.
And they even came back to me and said, are you sure they're Jewish? And I said, yes. They asked me, are you sure they're Jewish? Didn't slip under the radar. Are you sure they're Jewish? Yes. Okay, I made a serious mistake, but it was a mistake intended as a compliment. Now, the article came out online at 12:01 that Sunday morning, the last Sunday in July 2017, and somebody started tweeting about it immediately.
Yeah, immediately.
So how did that happen? How does that happen?
That's why I said you were stitched up.
From London.
Yeah.
So that somebody had been tipped off. somebody had been tipped off, had to have been tipped off from within the Sunday Times, and because they had to access the Irish edition from London. So they were doing that within minutes. And then not merely did they access the Irish edition, they knew which page to go to. And I was accused of misogyny as well, because, you know, the two women are the two women. And so on and so forth. The thing just accumulated. By 8 o'clock in the morning, my career was over.
Yeah.
By midday, I had been publicly sacked by the Sunday Times without a single phone call from any in management. Not one single phone call. Asking what was going on here? No explanation, no regrets, nothing. Publicly vilified in a way that I have never known any journalist to be vilified in my life. Now, I'm not some kind of secret Nazi. I am, as you know, Richie,
yeah,
maybe some of your audience will know, the only pro-Israel journalist in the Irish media. And I have been for many years. And you don't agree with my opinions, so that's fine.
Doesn't matter, yeah.
But those are my opinions. You can't call me an anti-Semite if you're so pro-Israel. And indeed, the Jewish representative body was not happy with my reference to the Jewish background of the two women concerned, but they recognized it was not intended as anti-Semitism. And in any of these affairs, you have to look out at the intent.
Of course.
What was my intent? My intent was a compliment. It was ill-conceived, ill-judged, but it was not meant to be anti-Semitic. And that's what the Jewish community in Ireland said. Then the lie came out, there was a Holocaust denier. That's a terrible, terrible slur, a terrible libel, the worst you can utter. It's completely untrue.
By the National
Broadcaster. The Jewish Representative Council said, Kevin Myers has told the Jewish people, sorry, the Irish people, truths about the Holocaust they would not otherwise have known. The Guardian called me a Holocaust denier and deleted that line from the Jewish representative body in its coverage of the affair. So no Guardian reader knows the truth about me. Online, the Guardian still says I'm a Holocaust denier. And when I complained to them about that, they said, well, we'll put in a footnote to say that you deny it. No, I don't deny it. It's a lie.
It's a lie. It's a lie, full stop. Yeah.
It's a lie.
Yeah.
And I won a court case against RTÉ, which called me a Holocaust denier. This is a public service broadcaster. I pay.
That you'd worked for.
RTÉ.
And you worked for
my license.
Yeah.
I pay, and every Irish citizen does. And they lied about me. And I sued them, and they settled out of court because they had to, because they knew the evidence against them was complete and irrefutable. The Irish RTÉ News never reported the settlement. The Irish Times never reported the settlement. The Guardian never reported the settlement. So you have journalists now, and uniquely in my lifetime, uniquely in my knowledge of journalism, agreeing to a consensual falsehood about another journalist whom they don't like. Now, I welcome their dislike. I'm happy they dislike me. It's good that they dislike me. I mean, who wants to be liked by cowards and liars? I don't want to be. So good, they don't like me, but they may not lie about me, and that's what they've done.
They don't deserve the name journalist. I mean, journalism is, I mean, thank God you RTÉ had to acknowledge that they'd libeled you. I wouldn't.
But
you know,
they did it briefly.
Briefly,
but they never reported
like,
the finding or the apology in their news bulletins.
I would argue it's always been the way with the media. When the media libels anybody or puts out inaccurate information about anybody, it does it in a big emblazoned headline, and then the apology is on page 7 in fine print that nobody can
read.
Historically,
you're right.
No.
You're absolutely right. But on this occasion, you'd think that the rival media, the Irish Times, would be a rival in the sense
absolutely.
That, you know, it competes for the same advertising with RTÉ. You'd think the Irish Times would say, hold on, Kevin Myers spent over 20 years writing about the Holocaust in our pages. The RTÉ have folded completely, have admitted that they were wrong, they admitted they had libeled them. This is a news story for our news pages. They didn't do that. They never reported the finding. They never reported the settlement. When I wrote to the Irish Times board and the Trust, these are two organizations which govern the morality of the Irish Times, complaining about what had been the negligence of the Irish Times, deliberate negligence, negligence isn't the right word, a deliberate policy of not reporting on the finding. I never got a letter from either the board or the Trust. So we have a triangle within the Irish Times of responsibility, of culpability. Within the news desk, with the Trust and the Board, all agreeing not to tell the truth about me, which is fine. It is fine. That's a reflection on them, not on me.
But it's not fine, though, Kevin. And while there isn't any sense of bitterness in you dealing with the episode in the book, there isn't, and I'm glad that there isn't. There is obviously another very important issue at stake here, and that is these institutions are supposed to be holding authority to account. And at the moment, and you touch on it briefly, at the moment we have governments, your government in Ireland, and I have to say, sadly, my government here in the UK, making decisions that are having catastrophic consequences for people's futures, their health, the future of their health and the well-being of their families, but also their finances. And the media is not present. It is asleep on its watch, Kevin.
That's, you're right.
That's where we are.
You're
it's
right.
Astonishing. That
now,
it's
I don't
come
read
to this.
Many newspapers, but I get feeds from you know, when I turn on my computer and I get stuff, I will go online and look stuff, and it's shocking.
Isn't it?
The absence of serious intellectual dissent, with the exception of Peter Hitchens in the Daily Mail, and Lionel Shriver in the Spectator, who's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And she has put together, and so has he, very coherent arguments against the shutdown policy and the hysteria surrounding this. I mean, the news came out the other day that, which you know, that 90% of the deaths in Britain are people in their 80s.
In their 80s, yeah. Yeah,
over 90%
with comorbidities. With comorbidities,
this is insanity.
It's insane.
These are people on. They're standing on the threshold of heaven anyway. To close down an economy, to wreck university lives, to destroy city centres, which might never recover again. This is grave immorality. I mean, if it's moral, it has to be discussed openly and vigorously and dissected. I mean, we are looking at not just an economic shift, but a cultural shift. Town centres or city centres have been a pivotal part in the way human society has operated in Western Europe for several centuries. We haven't been a rural people for many, many years. Now, what they're doing in everywhere, I was in Dublin the other day, it's shocking. It's like Chernobyl, you know, or the week after the meltdown. And I imagine the West End, it's the same, and the same in Manchester and Salford and all wherever the urban centres are.
Yeah, it's the same.
These places are being murdered by policy. And it might be right, the policy might be right, I can't say that it is, but if you are going to inflict this kind of punishment on people's fortunes, on their lives, on their future, you have to be able to discuss it, and discuss it vigorously and openly and ruthlessly. But when you've got that ridiculous creature, Keir Starmer, who's even more absurd than Boris Johnson. And I wouldn't have thought it was possible for anyone to be more absurd than Boris Johnson.
Yeah, he wants...
I would have thought he's the ultimate buffoon.
He wants more lockdown, Starmer. You see,
he wants more lockdown. Starmer wants more lockdown.
Yeah, he wants more lockdown, yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
you know,
competition.
Kevin, you talked a few minutes ago about The Guardian and The Times failing to report the truth about you after the settlement with RTE. And all the rest of it. We see the same today with coronavirus. We have broadsheet newspapers that are ignoring epidemiologists from Ivy League universities like Oxford, like Cambridge and like Harvard. Ignoring them. These are men and women whose qualifications equal or better the qualifications of the government advisors. And these people are saying lockdown is insane. It kills more people. You've got to let herd immunity build up. And this is why I went back to the state of the media. These bastards, and I shouldn't say that, but they are willfully keeping these people off the pages of their newspapers. I mean, we're a banana republic then.
It's not a banana republic. It's much larger than...
A lot worse than that, yeah.
...country. It's much, much larger than this. It is a major event in world history. Not the disease. It's the response. It's equivalent of the Reformation or the Counter-Reformation or this is a major shift because it's coinciding with the brainwashing of young people in social media, who arrive at universities knowing nothing. They can't spell. They know nothing about the world. They know nothing about history. They don't even know what the Reformation is or the Renaissance is. They just know nothing. And these are history students. History students arrive in their first year at university in Britain and Ireland without ever having heard of the Reformation or the Renaissance. So not merely have we got delinquent governments driven by hysteria, this is colliding with a new generation that has been stripped of all knowledge by woeful and terrible teaching, and that much of this teaching has been ideologically driven, and neo-Marxist. So we have reached a civilizational crisis unlike anything that has occurred in a very long time. In terms of civilizational crisis, this would match the triumph of communism and the triumph of Nazism. If you are going to look at the three great events of the last 120 years, it would be, I think, the arrival of communism, then the arrival of its brother creed, Nazism, and they are pretty much cut from the same cloth. And now we have this new calamity, where we have people who know nothing and who are determined to learn nothing and who are all equally determined to prevent contrary opinions being heard. Now, as you know, in my career as a journalist in Ireland, I had a reputation for being a contrarian. I wasn't deliberately so, but I found myself not agreeing with the consensus. That's the way my brain works. I don't deliberately look for trouble, but I found myself in trouble.
Yeah.
they destroyed me because I was a contrarian. I didn't go along with the consensus. And now who dares to contest the policy of government in Britain or Ireland or Europe or anywhere? Because if you do, you suffer the same fate as Kevin Myers.
You're going the way of
now,
Kevin.
Who wants to go down that road? Look, I'm an old man. What they did to me destroyed my reputation internationally and did me a great deal of financial damage. But I'm an old man. I don't need to have savings or anything. Had I been a young journalist, age 27, woman or man, my career would have ended and I would never have got a job again.
Never, no.
And this is what's happening. No journalist dare dissent. And then we have this final feature, and it's so complex, of the Black Lives Matter. And then the immediate capitulation of Keir Starmer going down on one knee because of the death of one man in Minneapolis.
It's
that's
ridiculous.
Complete insanity.
It's ridiculous, yeah.
The complexities of American political life can't in any way be represented by footballers going down on one knee in Manchester or Leicester, where I was born, or London. It doesn't solve anything. What it does do, it creates an atmosphere and culture of intimidation and terror so that you may not dissent without being called a racist.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there.
So we enter the time of volitional despotism, not possible to dissent from agreed policy, whether it's a football pitch or whether it's wearing a mask in the city centre of any city, or having a debate with university students about what is right and what is wrong. There is no debate now because it's not possible. If you're on the wrong side of the debate, therefore you're an evil person. And we no longer use the term intellect to describe what's going on. We use morality.
Yeah,
and if somebody
differs
from us, if they have their opinions different from ours, they must be an immoral person. Now, you and I disagree, I think, profoundly on the issue of Israel and Palestine.
We do, but I would never have you cancelled. I would never, and I know you would never have me cancelled. I would never, ever have you cancelled. I like you. I don't care that you're a supporter of the State of Israel and that. Why would I? Of course, I profoundly disagree with you because of, you know, because.
That's my point.
Absolutely, but I would never see you cancelled.
We haven't discussed that. We just both know that you and I, and maybe one of these days when we finally meet, we'll have a bit
of banter, yeah.
Find a common ground on the Israel-Palestine thing. It really doesn't matter. We both know that we, in our own moderate ways, in my case, very modest way, a person, I think, of some integrity. And if you hold an opinion, it's not because you're a dishonest or wicked or immoral person. It's because your integrity takes you to that position.
Yeah.
And likewise for me. And likewise for most of your listeners. Most of us have opinions which we express because they represent our honest feelings and our honest intellectual approach to matters. We analyze things. We come to conclusions. We try not to get too many emotions involved because emotions are not good tools for examining anything. But, you know, if you're 19 years of age and you've been raised on social media, how do you know how to contain your emotions? Because you've been told all along that emotions are everything. You've been told all along that a serious analysis of your history is wrong. It's patriarchal, or it's imperialistic, or it's warmongering, or all the terrible things you're not allowed to be anymore. So they have been fed taboos. They have been fed inhibition. They're not even enjoying sex or drugs or alcohol anymore, no. I'm told. Their lives are extremely restricted by all sorts of forces, the likes of which I can't understand. But God, I do feel sorry for them. Now, I would be old enough to be the grandfather of these kids at school, university. And I pity them. I don't think there has been a more cursed generation, apart from those who had to go off to war, in not just my lifetime, but in a generation or two or three or four generations.
They're being conditioned,
because
Kevin.
Their lives are blighted within a democracy by the failings of politicians and the failures of teachers and the failures of journalism.
And the thing about it is, they're being conditioned into believing that it is possible to navigate life without ever being confronted by things you don't like to see or hear. That's incredible. And I've witnessed this over the last few years. Social media, of course, creates the environment for that to flourish, because on social media, you get to just surround yourself with people who agree with you. You never have to listen to people.
I'm not on social media. I'm not on Facebook.
I don't miss anything.
I don't know how to get onto Facebook or the other thing, Twitter thing. I don't know how that thing exists. I do have a telephone. I have a laptop, and I'm available on online. And you can give out my email address if you want to people, because I don't mind people contacting me. I'm happy to hear people contacting me. But these are sewers. You can't swim through a sewer, I'm talking about social media, and emerge intact. You might think you smell sweet, but you don't. But you will have ingested viruses that will never go away. Yeah. There'll be bacteria in your colon that will be with you forever and ever and ever. There is no compatibility between social media and civilization. One or other has to give, and unless civilization controls social media, civilization itself will die. And I'm not being hyperbolic, and I'm not exaggerating. That's my genuine opinion.
People need to get off.
We can't continue down this path.
No.
We can't continue with conformism and consensuality backed by terror and of cancellation and of career ruination.
Here's my final question. We've gone into overtime as well. This is beautiful. You see, this is the wonderful thing of me doing what I do now. I'm not, bound or constricted by any scheduling. I can stay on air and be as live as long as I want. But I'll ask you a final question. Before I do that, Burning Heresies, A Memoir of a Life in Conflict, 1979 to 2020, Kevin Myers, published by Merrion Press. Do pick up a copy, folks. It's available all good online retailers, and it will be in your local bookshop as well if you can sum up the courage to get out of your house and go to your high street. It's a great read, Kevin, and I'm delighted that I got a hold of it. And thanks to your publishers for sending it to me. Not all publishers do that. Here's the final question then. Where does it go? Is there any hope? I mean, you've just given the answer. People need to get off social media, re-engage with people, leave their egos aside, accept that they are surrounded by people who see the world differently. It doesn't mean that the person who sees the world differently to you is evil. It means, as you very eloquently said, they've experienced life, they've analysed it in a different way. You've given one of the answers. Where is it going to go? What's your gut instinct? Is there any hope for us?
I'm very pessimistic, but if there is any progress, it begins in universities. Universities will announce to all incoming students that there will be no safe spaces.
Yeah.
They will hear things that they don't like. Now, the York University last year apologized to students because of one of the titles in the reading titles was Nigger of the Narcissus, which is a novel by Conrad. Another university had to apologize because the term Negro came up.
Wow.
Now, Negro is the term used by Martin Luther King speaking about his own people. Negro is very, and obviously Negro is an unpleasant word, but it's not the end of the world. Lots of an unpleasant word. And once you're 18, you're going to hear lots of things you don't like and lots of things you disapprove of. But we cannot allow universities to become the pioneer of repression. We cannot allow campuses to be to host festivals of ignorance and a triumph of political correctness. That's the opposite of what universities are meant to be. They are meant to open people's minds. They're meant to give people the amazing sensation of learning new things and hearing opinions they heartily dislike, So they then have to dismantle those opinions.
Yeah.
And maybe in the dismantling of those opinions, they'll realize that maybe those opinions have virtues as well. And that means you hear every single word in the English language, every single word, and don't say, oh, don't say that word in front of me. Grown-ups hear nasty words, and they live with it. And that's what the universities have to do. Now, but I don't see a university chancellor or vice chancellor standing up against the mob. I mean, in university, Richard Dawkins has just been banned from Trinity College Dublin. Richard Dawkins, the most important thinker on the issue of evolution living today. He's been disinvited. He's been cancelled by the university, by Trinity College Dublin.
For what reason, Kevin?
But this is completely insane. It's completely insane. There is no more important thinker on evolution than him. And I don't agree with a lot of what he says on evolution, but I'd love to hear him again.
Yeah.
But if I was a student at Trinity College Dublin, I wouldn't be allowed to. It's just universities doing this. This is an incredible violation of the understanding of what tertiary education is about. It is a violation of the academic norms going back to the foundation of the universities in the 9th and 10th centuries, and in Trinity's case, to the time of Queen Elizabeth I. This is historically one of the great universities of the world, and now it's become one of the great kind of epicentres of repression. It is so tragic as to be untrue, and we're not dealing now just with the issue of undergraduates today. Those undergraduates will be in positions of power and influence in 25 years' time. They'll be prime ministers, they'll be government ministers, they'll be writers, academics, teachers. And what filth and what idiotic nonsense will they be feeding into the ears of the students of that generation? So we are on a cultural slide to which there is no bottom. This is a nadir without an abyss, an abyss without a nadir. It just goes on and on and on. Because no one's standing up. No one in the House of Commons, in Britain or in Dáil Éire in Ireland is saying, but we've had enough. Enough weakness, enough cowardice, enough consensuality, enough complicity in a general agreed consensus. No, we are now going to allow people to speak their minds. No matter how much we dislike what we hear, we are going to allow them. But Lawrence Fox, the actor, as you know,
Now
his career is over as an actor. And where is equity on this? Actors' equity. Why are they not closing down television stations because of this? Nothing's happening.
We're living in the era.
As far as I can understand, heartily agree with his being closed down. As essentially, most journalists in Ireland and Britain agreed with what happened to me.
Yeah, that's right. We're living in a time, Kevin.
No question about it.
We're living in.
There are thousands of journalists in Britain and Ireland, and three or four only stood up for me. Not.
Kevin has dropped out there. Oh, you're back. You're back.
No one must.
Sorry, you dropped out, Kevin, momentarily. No, you dropped out momentarily, just for a second, and you came back.
The one thing listeners must not in any way feel I'm a victim. I'm not a victim. Are you listening to me? Do I sound as a victim? I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm well, and I feel fantastic, and I've got great friends, and you've been a great friend, even though we've never met. Be a great friend online. So the people you couldn't be concerned about are not old codgers like me. But the young people coming through schools and universities now, something has to be done to rescue their brains before they're destroyed by silliness and cowardice, and before they learn that the only way to get ahead in life is to comply with what everyone else is saying.
Yeah.
The only way to get ahead in life is to follow your conscience, and that conscience has to be developed. It has to be fed with information. It's got to be given moral courage to make unpopular decisions and to go where that conscience will take you. You must go and hang the consequences. And unless we raise children like that, then we're incapable of defending ourselves against any foe. And this is a world in which there are foes. We have the kind of strange foes of Russia, which I can't make out, but they're very sinister. And we have this new totalitarian beast in the Far East. I'm not talking about the Chinese people, I'm talking about the regime in China, which oppresses not merely the Chinese people, but millions of Muslims. 2 million Muslims are in concentration camps in China, and the world says nothing.
The Uyghur Muslims, yeah.
The world
yeah.
says nothing about 2 million Muslims in concentration camps.
It's gotten a lot of coverage on UK media has covered it. Let's get into that. Let's get into that again in the future, because again, we see that a little bit differently, but that's no big deal either. Just before we go today, I want to two things. what you've described there is essentially, it's not just Orwell's Ministry of Truth, but it is binary choice. They're teaching children that there's an answer to everything, and it's fairly blunt, it's fairly binary, and that's the answer. Debate is no longer required. That's it. This is the answer. And that's terrible. And I see that happening all the time. You mentioned Dawkins, just for our listeners who might not know what's happened there. He's been disinvited, as Kevin just said, because apparently of his views on Islam and sexual assault. Jesus wept. You know, when I was at university, if a visiting speaker had some opinions that you didn't quite agree with, you couldn't wait to attend so that you could challenge him, Kevin. But now,
that's the point. That's the point.
It's madness.
That's the purpose of universities.
Yeah.
You got some bastard you really want to destroy intellectually. Yeah. Will you destroy him intellectually?
Have a go at him, yeah. But now let's ban him now. Let's get rid of him. Let's cancel him. This is all the rage. Cancel culture. Listen, I mean it when I say I loved the book. Our mutual friend who doesn't miss too many of these programs, you know who I'm talking about, she couldn't put it down either. It's shot through with humour and real warmth as well, which kind of surprised me. I felt a bit guilty. It's not that I don't see you as a warm person, but you said yourself you had this reputation as a contrarian. I probably would have subscribed to that, but I've lived and learned a bit. I think you're a vital voice. And I just want to read this, and I will give you the last word then. Of course I will, as I always do. The book is Burning Heresies, folks. It's a fantastic read. Do get a copy of it and treat yourself to it. I want to read you what the former Irish Justice Minister said in The Independent, because I thought it was lovely. He finished his stellar review of the book by saying, Kevin Myers has a voice that deserves to still be heard. He should be brought in out of the cold and his place in Irish journalism restored. His undeserved isolation and purgatory should end, as should any need to regularly ask himself, referencing his July 2017 column, did I really write that? I echo that completely. Your voice is lost in the Irish media. I miss reading you. And I'll give you the final word. Thanks for coming on, and congratulations again on the book. Final word to you.
Thank you for the final word, Richie. Thank you very much for being such a generous host, as always. I hate to identify somebody by their religion, but he's relevant in the context of me being called an anti-Semite. Alan Shatter, in addition to being perhaps the finest Minister for Justice and finest Minister for Defence in the history of the state, is himself Jewish. Now, he would not countenance or tolerate any scintilla of anti-Semitism, yeah, and he knows I'm not an anti-Semite, but it's relevant in the circumstances it wouldn't otherwise be. But I'm very grateful to have his good opinion, and he has my good opinion, in as much as that counts for anything, as indeed do you, Richie. Thank you very much for the kindness of this extended interview, and I'm grateful for the time you've given me.
I know you are. Thanks for coming back, Kevin. I look forward to speaking to you hopefully sometime before Christmas about other matters. It's getting crazy. And I'd like to have you on, given your opinion. There's no doubt about that. Speak real soon. Thanks, Kevin. Sláinte amhail.
Okay, thanks, Richie.
Bye for now. Kevin Myers, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Monday into overtime because, well, you couldn't cut that short, could you? Fascinating stuff there. Particularly, you know, talking about his experiences of Beirut earlier on. It's an amazing story in the book. It's so vivid that to be subjected to a mock execution. I can't imagine how anybody would get through that. But those experiences around Bosnia and around the Middle East and the Far East, of course, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, I should say, and the north of Ireland, those experiences only make up part, really, of his story as a journalist. It's a great read. I recommend it. And nobody has paid me to say that. I really did enjoy the book. That's it, then. I'll get this on turnaround as quick as I can. We'll get it on Podomatic and Spotify and the usual. Back with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time. Until then, thanks to Kevin again. And thanks, of course, to Simon Dolan. And we will follow up, when it's on Netflix, we'll follow up Another Way, the documentary with Simon Dolan, Sean Collins, and directed by Charlotte Fantelli. We'll maybe get Sean on, maybe Charlotte, who knows. I look forward to seeing that documentary as well. Leaving with John Denver. See you tomorrow. Bye now. Bye. We should be leaving with John Denver. There you are. A live version of Country Road.